This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue in the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, Souls Harbor Rescue Mission now has two locations in the CBRM. We'll get you up to speed about integrated youth services in the community. An exhibit in Sydney is paying tribute to a late artist and NSCC professor and a trailblazer for civil rights was recently acknowledged in Sydney with a gathering at the university and a new publication. These stories are coming up on the Coast. The Cape Breton Regional Municipality has a new drop-in center. It's located in the small town of New Waterford on the outskirts of Sydney. The Souls Harbor Rescue Mission will provide daily meals as well as clothing and essential items for people who are struggling financially. Their CEO, Michelle Porter, says it's difficult to say at this time how much food they'll have to dish out every day, but an event this past summer welcomed dozens of hungry patrons.
We're not sure how many people will come in on a regular basis, but we have found, you know, at least between 30 and 50 to start. However, when we were coming and working on Saturdays to do the barbecue, we actually had over 100 people attending those Saturday meals.
The drop-in center's chef is Jeff Parks. He's been cooking for 30 years. He tells Coast Radio that the menu will have comfort food, including some local fish favorites.
Comfort food is, generally speaking, it's hot, but it's food that you would have grown up in your household as a child eating, something that your mom would have cooked, something that your grandma would have cooked, and it's something that, you know, I do have experience in fine dining. I could cook really complicated stuff, but I don't think the people that are coming here really want that. And sometimes they'll get items that they wouldn't normally try, so they get to try something new.
The drop-in center's manager, Krista McPhee, says the community is the driving force that's keeping the doors open and the shelves full. She says food donations are expected to feed as many people as they need to, and there is a long list of volunteers willing to help.
Well, I think that this venture has just proven to us exactly the generosity that Cape Bretoners have. They love helping out. Like I said before, we have almost 70 people that have signed up to volunteer. We have people that are dropping things off all the time before we were even open. They're just so excited, and the community has just backed us up the whole time.
There are now two Souls Harbor Rescue Mission drop-in centers in Cape Breton. The other one is in Sydney Mines. While Coast Radio was chatting to the New Waterford crew, the manager of their sister location, Alana McClellan, was on site. She agrees that the community's generosity is crucial to keep both facilities operating. And she goes on to say there are other levels of comfort some people crave, like having the opportunity to socialize.
I mean, we all know that loneliness is the epidemic of the 21st century. And so we say, like, food for the belly, food for the soul. And so we're not a takeout model. We are a model where we break bread together, we sit, we eat together, we build relationships. And then through those relationships, we can help grow and support one another and connect to other services that are available to help support people in need.
The Souls Harbor Rescue Mission also has a food truck that delivers food to people in New Waterford and Sydney Mines if they have mobility or transportation challenges. Late artist and NSCC professor Brian Geary's work is currently on display at the Cape Breton Center for Craft and Design in an exhibit called A Natural Evolution. Dialogue's Cora Perrigo spoke to several patrons at the opening for the show, as well as a former student of his, Stephanie Steele.
I'm Tina Marie Fancy. I'm a member of the Center for Craft and Design, and I met Brian through when I was an employee here. And something tells me I may have actually met him prior to that because I was involved in the arts community for a long time, as, of course, he was. I was asked by Claire and Greg Bishop and Holly Grant to help hang the show. I was very honored that I was asked, and had a great time doing it. So many beautiful pieces to choose from and curate. He was a magnificent artist, and I always thought he was a consummate gentleman, and he was just a really nice person.
So my name is Greg Davies. I'm the curator of the CBU Art Gallery, and I'm here at the Brian Geary exhibition. It's wonderful to see all these works together. I think it's been very nicely curated, I have to say. It's interesting to see a collection of primarily abstracts, which I associate with Brian's work. But there is at least one landscape in there, which is also nice to see in the context of all these other works. It helps us situate some of his abstract work in the context of the land, which I think was an influence. I didn't actually know Brian. I knew about him when I came here in 2017. But I didn't personally know him. I did speak to him once, but it was very brief. And so I wish... I know some of the people here tonight have spent a lot of time with Brian and knew him well. I wish I'd had the chance to get to know him a little bit better at the time.
I'm Claire Hinchy. I'm his wife. And we met about 19 years ago when he came to Cape Breton. And we had 18 lovely, wonderful years. I taught at Riverview High School, and he was at the college, and we did lots of traveling, lots of art, and lots of fun. Brian came to Cape Breton. He was in Grand Prairie, and it was interesting. A very good friend of our family said, "Brian, there's an excellent job for you at Nova Scotia Community College. It's just perfect for you." So he did come in December of 1992, and he's been there ever since. He had such a thirst and a joy for art and students. He just loved working with students. And it's interesting because he would do his art, and every morning he would get up and he would go downstairs and he would work on a piece. And then a couple of days later, he'd go and he'd work some more. But he just loved art. And what happened with Brian also is that he did realism, as you see over there, the prairie picture. And he did realism for years and years. And then I guess as artists do, they transition to abstract. And hence the show is a lot of his abstract work. But he was into commercial, he was into jewelry, he was into silk screening. He loved all facets of art, and he was a wonderful, great person and a very sincere, loyal person. And he loved teaching at Nova Scotia Community College.
Hi there, I'm Stephanie Steele, and we're here at A Natural Evolution by Brian Geary at the Cape Breton Center for Craft and Design.
And why did you want to get involved in this exhibit?
Well, I'm a past student of Brian's, and I thought it was so wonderful to see his friends and family come together and bring this exhibition to life.
What impact has Brian Geary had on your life?
He's had a great impact on my artistic career. You know, Brian always had a way to make you believe in yourself and your dreams as an artist, and I think that's, you know, one of his greatest legacies that he left to us.
And for anybody who doesn't know who Brian is, do you want to kind of let people know?
Absolutely. Brian was my professor at NSCC for Communication Arts and Graphic Design, and he actually came here from Alberta. So he settled here in Cape Breton and lived here for the rest of his life, creating art and inspiring people like me.
What about Brian's art specifically made you want to put on like a show? Why did you want people to see it?
Well, I think it's important to, you know, to understand someone. I think when we see their art, we see their life. And I think it's important for people to be able to see this. Also, the fact that we can bring together so many people that he has inspired and that love him and, you know, are big fans of his work. So that's what I'm really excited about.
And I know you said he himself had an impact on your artistic career, but what about his art?
Oh, his art had a huge impact on me. I recall one time in class when he actually brought his art in for us to critique and to, you know, have our ideas about. And right away, when I looked at his work, I kind of shouted out, "Brian, it looks like I'm flying above Alberta. And he said, oh my gosh, you got it, and gave it away right away. I love, you know, his passion and the energy in his work. So that's great to see.
Do you have a favorite piece?
I do. I actually purchased the piece. It's a lovely, energetic, bright piece of work, and it reminds me of candy and good things that are sweet. So I was quite drawn to that right away, and I asked if I could purchase it, and they said yes.
What do you hope people take away from Brian and his art?
I think that they would see, you know, that Brian was an artist. It, you know, wasn't necessarily about making art and to make money. He just really, truly expressed his own energy, his own life in his pieces. And I think that people will really see that. And as I'm looking now, I honestly see that same kind of, we're flying above Alberta, the sectioned off little pieces that we see of the land. And, you know, I just love it because it's like his home, you know. He was so connected to his home, but then, you know, he gave his life to so many students and so many people in the art world.
Do you have a favorite memory of Brian as a professor?
Okay, I do have one beautiful memory, and that was, I think I just spoke to you about this, was when, you know, back many years ago when I was his student, he was on a long wait list to have an exhibition at Cape Breton University Gallery. And he was so excited about it. And he said, I'm showing in 5 years. Make sure you're there. And I said, I'm going to be there. And he said, I'll tell you one thing. You know, if you've made it as an artist, if you get a show at CBU Gallery. And I have to say, you know, Brian, we made it. I currently have a show at the Cape Breton University. And you know, right now, showing alongside Brian here on Cape Breton Island is so, it just makes my heart beam with joy.
Why do you think Brian had such an impact on the people around him?
I think because his honesty and his true love for art really shone through. And simply the fact that he really did make you believe in yourself. Whatever little dream you had or big dream, he let you know, you can do this. You just need to take the steps and listen to your heart.
And how long have you been involved in like exhibiting Brian's work or just getting him noticed?
Well, the first time I was actually having a show here at Cape Breton Center for Craft and Design, and so at that time, Brian had recently passed away, and Claire, you know, connected with me, and the people at Cape Breton Center for Craft and Design connected with me, and we thought that it would be a wonderful thing to show both my work and his work at the same time. So that was the first time that we showed his work. And isn't that funny how we showed his work in my first show at Cape Breton Center for Craft, and now we're exhibiting at the same time as well. It's kind of like the universe just being magical.
And what is the connection between his art and your art? What made the through line?
The connection. Well, I think, you know, he has a lot of freedom in his art. Sometimes my art is a little bit restricted, but I always am eager to, you know, attach myself to that energy like Brian, to be free and to be that way. So it's a journey. It's a journey.
Are there any kind of themes you notice in Brian's art that are kind of consistent?
Yes, actually. And I do have to say, I have several pieces of Brian's work also at my home. And here, you know, we see a lot of repetitive patterns and him really making his mark in such a unique way that, you know, in some of these pieces we're seeing it, you know, it's looking like a textile work, where in other pieces, you know, we've got a landscape right in front of us and this bright, bold, kind of elongated pieces, you know. I truly admire the fact that he can kind of go in between different realms of art and not be stuck in one theme.
And through exhibiting his art or just kind of sharing your memories and more publicity about him, has anybody approached you with any kind of memories, or what kind of connections have you made with people that Brian knew?
Yes, absolutely. People have approached me, including many members, many students of his, and I hope to see them on Thursday at the Cape Breton Center for Craft and Design. And also, of course, you know, the wonderful people that worked to put this show up, including Heather and Claire. I met Greg and a lot of lovely people. So, you know, he's got a great force behind him. And like I said, he leaves a wonderful legacy of inspiration.
In January, you heard an interview with Amanda Ray Stortebloom about the upcoming Integrated Youth Services Project with New Dawn. Now called Anchor Youth Space, the Resource Center for Youth is set to open in June. Dialogue's Cora Perrigo meets up with Amanda again to see how things have progressed.
And we talked before. How are things going?
Things are going really, really well. We are walking closer to an open date. We have a team on board who's been working hard behind the scenes to figure out what it's going to look like when we open. And yeah, we've had a very engaged youth advisory. I think last time we spoke, I was kind of recruiting for our youth advisory and our caregiver advisory. And we've been really lucky to have really engaged groups for both, and they've really been guiding our design of the space.
And how have those committees kind of influenced how the IYS in its kind of infancy is growing?
They have influenced it tremendously. You know, when I came on board, there was a rough floor plan. We're working within an old school building, so of course there's restrictions of the space, and a floor plan had been mapped out based on that. But through the space design process with our youth advisory and our caregiver advisory, we've actually made quite a few changes, including moving over some walls and adding doors and windows. And their input has had a tremendous impact. Some of the things that are really notable, I'll say expanding the group rooms that we had to be a little bit larger than what they originally were in the plan, so that there's space to have more of a comfy setup as opposed to tables and chairs. Another notable one for me is we have a teaching kitchen that was already in the plans, and through the input with our youth advisory, they said, well, great that there's a teaching kitchen, but what if there's a class happening in the kitchen and I come in and want a snack because I'm hungry? And so because of that input, we created a whole kitchenette area out in the main gathering space, so young people will be able to come in and help themselves to what's in the fridge or make a cup of tea or whatever they would like. Yeah.
And I know we spoke about it before, but if anybody missed it, kind of what's the goal of IYS?
Sure. Yeah. Integrated Youth Services is intended to be a one-stop shop for youth who are coming in to access services or need a space to hang out in the community. So the model is intended to be early intervention, prevention, and helping to get youth engaged and connected to services maybe earlier than they would have before things get to a really intense place.
And has there anything that's kind of surprised you through the process?
Yeah, there have been a few things that have surprised me. I'm trying to think specifically, but I know with our we went through a really detailed space design process, and that involved a little bit of visioning of what the youth wanted the space to look and feel like. And then we translated that into colors and textures and furniture and design of certain zones, we're calling them. And, you know, it's a very large space that we're working with, so we've kind of boiled it down to zones of activity. And there were sometimes through the space design process where, like the young people were saying like, oh yeah, I would have, that makes sense to me. That's how I would have thought of it too. But there was actually some things that the perspective of the young people was totally different than what I would have thought or what I would have done. And so, it just goes to show the critical importance of really putting the people who you're building a space for at the center of that space and building a process that captures the best of their input in ways that are really going to transform and impact the space.
It seems like it's kind of, in a way, I know you have the team, but it's with the committees, very for the youth, by the youth.
Yeah, it is. That's one of the principles of an integrated youth services model. Integrated youth services has been used across the country, and we're adopting it here Nova Scotia-wide. I think we chatted about this before, but there's 8 sites opening across the province, and we're the second one to open, or possibly third, depending. Yeah, that having it by the youth, for the youth, is really one of the core tenets of having an integrated youth services model, and I'm really proud of how we've done that here. You know, we're IYS, which actually has a name now. It's called Anchor Youth Space. And so Anchor Youth Space is being built under the New Dawn umbrella. New Dawn is the lead agency with our coalition partners, BGC and the Pier, Undercurrent Youth Center, and the Cape Breton Youth Project. And because it's under New Dawn, I mean, New Dawn is this is what they're all about, is putting the community at the center of what they're doing. And so I've really been given the liberty and the freedom and the space to do that here. And really our young people have, been integral in it. And, you know, one thing I will also say is it was really lovely to see, because Integrated Youth Services, Anchor Youth Space will be for youth 12 to 25 and their caregivers. So we had a separate caregiver advisory, and the caregiver advisory would meet after the youth advisory would meet. So everything they did built on what the youth did. And I was really, it just really struck my heart to see how even the caregiver advisory would be asking us as facilitators, well, what did the youth say about this? And they also wanted to center the youth perspective over their own. And that really struck me for sure.
Is there any kind of part of the development that you're excited to see come to fruition? I know the whole thing, but is there any specific part?
Oh my gosh, it's so hard to choose. Going back to this idea of zones, I love how the young people decided on different zones of activity. So we have one area that's sort of been dubbed the co-working space, and it's got these round tables where young people can play board games or work together on projects. There's another area that they've called the Zen Den, and that's going to be what was the former stage. And it's a bit of a darker, low-lit area. That, too, is another area where I'm like, I don't know how that'll come together, but I'm really excited to see how it manifests. And we also, as part of the input of the young people, have a separate room that's the movement room. And I'm curious to see how young people will use that space. It was something that wasn't necessarily in the original plan, but through our consultation with young folks, they kind of said, like, it's great that we're building all these calming Zen spaces, but sometimes I just, like, want to hit a punching bag, or, like, I have stuff to let out. And so I'm really excited to see how they use that space as well.
And kind of building on, I guess, the idea of the teaching kitchen, the kind of implication there is that there will be people in to teach. Do you have kind of any collaborations or partnerships coming down the pipeline that you're excited about?
Yeah, we do. Not enough to, like, say the particulars yet, but I will say, like, food is also something that New Dawn has done a lot of work in the community around and has longstanding relationships. You know, Meals on Wheels is a program here. We have Cafe Marie. We have an incredible catering area of New Dawn. And so, and they've also been a like a container in terms of community food work, holding a bit of an incubator space for different initiatives. So I'm excited to see how we'll be able to draw on those existing relationships to use the space here. There's also other programs, like, for example, YMCA Edge is right here in the building with us in Noonan Center. And as part of the pre-employment programming that they offer, they bring in someone to teach young people some basic cooking skills. They'll be able to use our kitchen to do that. So, yeah, there's a lot bubbling around. I think that that kitchen will get lots of use. There's many partners in the community excited about it. And I think, you know, with the being on this Noonan campus, right in behind us, we kind of back onto the courtyard for Eleanor's Court. They've got some gardening that's going to be happening there. So I don't know exactly what it's all going to look like, but I'm super curious to see how the collaborations will transpire on the Noonan campus, even from like growing things to cooking things. So it's really exciting.
And to kind of elaborate on that, it kind of seems like this specific space in Noonan is kind of just this environment of collaboration and cooperation. Was it important kind of to have IYS or Anchor Youth Services?
Anchor Youth Space.
In this kind of area to kind of be a part of all of that?
Yeah. You know, the decision to have it here was before my time, so I don't know if I can really speak to like what was the intention, but I can certainly speak to what has been manifesting. And you know, where we're located in the center of Noonan campus, it really does feel like we're kind of the heart of the campus, and the young people will be the heart of the campus. And definitely the collaboration, cooperation is in the ethos of how Noonan works and how this campus operates. And there's so much excitement over how like, say, for example, the Arts Center will influence the design of our space, not so much in the startup, but, you know, as it gets lived into. And same thing now, Eleanor's Court is open in behind us. But then there's also lots of space for the young people who are accessing Anchor Youth Space to influence those other buildings. So, yeah, I would say yes, that's exactly how it's manifesting. I don't know if that was the intention, but it's certainly happening that way.
And if people wanted to find out about the opening, are you able to speak if there's any kind of events happening to celebrate the opening?
Yes. So we're just waiting on the confirmation of the grand opening, the celebration of it, probably the last week of June. But as soon as it's confirmed, it will be on the Noonan channels. We actually do have, now that we have the Anchor Youth Space name announced, we're Anchor Youth Space Sydney, because all across Nova Scotia they'll be called Anchor Youth Space. We have a website, so if you Google search Noonan and Anchor Youth Space, we have our own website. You'll be able to see that space design process that I've mentioned on there. You'll be able to access any of the multimedia we've put up, and we'll also put our announcements about the grand opening and when it's confirmed, and folks will be able to come down and see what we've built here.
Paul McDougall of The Good Sentence talks to CBU Professor Emeritus Graham Reynolds about his recently released biography of Wanda Robson. Wanda was the youngest sister of Viola Desmond and a champion of her story and race relations in Nova Scotia.
So, Graham, why don't you just tell our Coast listeners just a little bit about, your relationship and how you first met Wanda and how then it morphed into this whole thing with Viola and the chair in social justice at CBU and everything else.
Yes. Well, first off, Paul, it's really good to be with you and to tell a story. The first thing that's really important is that you realize that Wanda really was the prime mover of the whole story behind Viola Desmond. She really took it from the further sort of shadows of Canadian history and brought Viola's name forward and fought tirelessly for social justice for her sister, who was wrongfully arrested way back in 1946 when she happened to enter the Roseland Theater in New Glasgow to watch a movie, and was told that she had to sit up in the balcony, which was segregated from the white section at the lower section of the theater. And she resisted, and as a result, of course, was arrested and found guilty of violating the amusement tax at the time, which was one penny difference in the price of the ticket between the upper the balcony and the lower section of the theater. So she had to eventually she pleaded guilty and paid the fine and was released. She was very forcefully removed, manhandled and bruised, and had a number of bruises on her body. All this kind of worked out in the court. She lost an appeal against this conviction. But the story, of course, resonated with the black community, and people in the community were very much, you know, upset with the whole situation involving racial segregation, which was really, we look back and say, this was a terrible part of our history, and it was very widespread during the period in which she was in which she protested this practice at the Roseland Theater. So that story kind of faded out of public consciousness for a number of years, and then around the beginning of the 20th century, 2000 exactly, the spring of 2000, Wanda, her younger sister, who of course knew the story and had it in her mind, decided she wanted to take a course at CBU. That was a course I was teaching in race relations at the time. And she was at that time in her life, she was 73 years old. She had raised her family. She had been a single mother and raised three children. She remarried to Joe Robson in North Sydney, and they had two more children. They all were raised and gone to school, and she had time in her hands. So she said, you know, I think maybe I should finish that degree that I wanted to start years and years ago. So she, with her husband's encouragement, called me in my office back in the spring of 2000 and said, Professor Reynolds, do you mind if I come to your course and maybe sit in? It's been a long time, over 50 years since I've been in a university course, and I'd like to see if I could just take in the course. And I said, of course, you could come and sit in. And she arrived and immediately fit into the class. We had about 18 students at that time, and you know, of course, she was 73 years old, but the students just took her in hand and really just were very fond of her as being motherly and very keen to learn. And of course, that's the one thing that's important about university. It doesn't matter how old you are, it's really a place to learn, no matter how old and what background you have. So she really fit in very well, and the kids in the course loved her. And I've discovered very soon after the course began that she was the younger sister of Viola Desmond. And I knew the story, and I was telling that to the students. And to discover that she was the youngest daughter of Viola Desmond was a special bond for us that that started a relationship that really just grew over time. And we sort of would talk in my office as she went through her university courses, and she had a schedule that happened to match my open times in the afternoon, and mostly on Tuesdays and Thursdays, she would arrive in my office, and we'd sit for sometimes over an hour just to talk about all sorts of things. But invariably, it always came back to the story of Viola and to the whole background of racial segregation in Canada and Nova Scotia in particular. So from that, she was, I think, encouraged to try to tell that story to a broader audience. And at the same time, she was involved in storytelling. She had met a poet and storyteller from Halifax, David Woods. He's a very well-known poet and artist and community historian as well. And that helped to hone her skills a little bit about telling stories. And it was really toward the end of her, just after she graduated, to be precise, in 2004, we started going to local schools, and she'd tell her story and bring up, of course, all the details about Viola and other stories related to the Roseland Theater incident. And that just kind of spread. And in a short period of time, no matter, a couple of years, she was invited to schools in Halifax, and then soon after that, she was in Toronto and Ottawa and Winnipeg. In her 80s now, she was just on a mission to tell the story and to raise public consciousness. And wherever we could, wherever she was, where I was in terms of being able to be with her, I would try to be there as well. Then she had an interview with the Herald in 2009, and she was visiting a friend in Halifax, and she was interviewed. The story hit the Herald, and it was a two-part series, actually, that resonated with the audience, and the legislature picked it up, and before we knew it, there was the proposal to issue a free pardon to Viola Desmond. And May Ann Francis, Nova Scotia's first black lieutenant governor, issued the free pardon, and the ceremony in Halifax in April 2010, they announced formally the free pardon and an official apology to Viola Desmond and to the black community in Nova Scotia for Viola's wrongful arrest in 1946. And it just so happened that the president of Cape Breton University, John Harker, and his wife Eunice were at the event, and Wanda was the key speaker, and she was praising Cape Breton University and made a few kind comments about me. And the next thing I know, I get a call from President Harker asking me if I would be the first chair of the Viola Desmond Chair in Social Justice at Cape Breton University. I accepted the honor, of course. And that began another sort of chapter in this whole story, where Wanda and I worked together as being part of the chair. We wrote two books together and spread the word as far as we could across Canada. I wrote a particular a book that was aimed at schools, in particular raising consciousness amongst students, in a book called Viola Desmond's Canada, History of Blacks and Racial Segregation in the Promised Land. That was published in 2016. And then we did together a biography of Viola Desmond, The Life and Times of Viola Desmond, and that was published in 2018. So it just never seemed to end. Of course, from that, we were in a situation where Viola was now a national figure and moved from the recesses of Canadian history to being a prominent figure and a civil rights icon. And that put her on the list for possible candidates for the $10 bill, which was part of a new series that the Bank of Canada was issuing, a new, more durable Palmer note that they were issuing, and they wanted to tell the story of Canada, and they decided, well, no better way to start this than to pick a prominent woman. So they opened up a public contest for people to give their nominations, and from that long list of over 400 candidates that were submitted by the public, they got down to a short list, and then eventually it was announced that that Viola Desmond was the chosen person to represent this new bill. And so we now see her every time we reach for our wallets and a $10 bill comes out. You can see a picture of Viola Desmond.
It's truly
a story.
It's truly a remarkable story. Is there a, think about back to that day she walked into your office and then in that class, Race Relations in North America, which I should add, I took that class from Graham for our listeners many years before Wanda, and it was one of the most interesting classes I've taken anywhere. So that's a pitch for that course. But think back to then, Graham. Is there any chance, any hope or thought that this woman you're with, a small, a tiny little woman, motherly-like figure, her sister is eventually going to be on the $10 bill? I mean, it must be like, when you think back, it must be just like incredulous, right?
Well, this was a movement that started with her. I mean, there were other people involved, and we could have another show on all the other people that she drew into her orbit. This is a significant event that was brought about largely by the efforts of a single person. And that really is the lesson I think that's important to take from this, is that, you know, you can make a difference and the single person can affect change. And with the case of Wanda, it was that unrelenting persistence that she had and that special kind of quality to connect with people. I could tell you story after story of how she did this. And it was always, you know, from the heart. Mm-hmm. She would be, I'd see her going up to see President Harker, and she'd have a home-baked cinnamon coffee cake tucked under her arm. She was going along with her walker, you know, at 87 or 88 years old, making her way to the president's office. And as a result of that contact, of course, we had the Wanda Robson and the Viola Desmond Scholarship Program at CBU. And there's a very successful scholarship that's under her name. I think they had 12 or more recipients this year in the Wanda Robson Scholarship Program, and that wasn't a token either. It was a fairly substantial amount of money for each of those recipients. So a really tremendous success, and the story keeps going. I mean, I think that the biography certainly will help to seal and perhaps in that permanent way create the record of Wanda as being part of Canadian history, which she so much deserves.
Yeah, definitely.
So I'm very happy with how things have turned out and been quite, as I said before, an honor and a privilege to be part of this.
You say in the book, which is titled The Life of Wanda Robson, Canada's Advocate for Viola Desmond and Social Justice, you credit her son and husband Joe Robson for encouraging you to do the biography, right? Because you say you didn't really think that you were going to do that because a lot of it's been told, but there is so much more to Wanda's life, that those beginning years in Halifax. As a former lab technologist for many years, I'm intrigued by the fact that she started out working in the fisheries lab in Halifax, and then she ended up falling for a baseball player, and they moved to the States with three sons, and then that really doesn't work out very well, so she moves back. She's a single mother, and then she meets Joe, and then they eventually move to Cape Breton, North Sydney, and which I find interesting too, because Viola was coming to Sydney, right, when her car broke down and she got stuck in New Glasgow.
Yes, she was.
I always find that a fascinating part of the story, a little Sydney connection. And then, so there's, you know, you've got the story. So why don't you just tell a little bit about, how you came to write the book.
I had a conversation with Gordon Neal. That's Wanda's son, who lives in Vancouver. And he said to me, he said, you know, you should do something about this. And he said, you know, her life is so interesting. And she really said she lived, almost four different lives in her 95 years. And she had a childhood that a loving family that she grew up in. It was unusual in its own sense of having, you know, she had, there were 15 kids in the family, 11 of them survived, and they had a very large family, and she, you know, learned to really appreciate not just the family but the community when she grew up in North End Halifax, and the church was part of her life. The music that she was introduced to, and she was a lover of music, very much like Viola and the rest of the family, for that matter. And so she had a very loving, caring family life, which really, I think, set her up to survive what was lying ahead of her. She happened by chance, before she even graduated in 1943, she happened by chance to see an article. In fact, her older brother pointed it out to her as an ad in the paper, in the Herald, advertising for a lab technician. They're looking for a young high school graduate male that could assume the role of a researcher that might go on and become a scientist, a researcher at the fisheries lab in Halifax. But of course, during the war, most of the men were fighting, and there weren't a lot of men that fit that description, young men. So she thought, well, I'm pretty good at school, and she did very well in spite of the difficulties of being, you know, discriminated against in many instances. But she came out very well, and she was in her senior year, and she thought, well, I'll put in my name for this position. And she got the job. And that started her beginning of what looked like a really promising career, because they would promote her through the ranks. You'd start at the bottom and washing the various implements they use, the various things they're using, their experiments, and then she moved up to being, you know, an assistant and so on. So she was on her way for a successful career as a researcher at the fisheries department. By chance, she met a young, promising superstar, from the States, Bomber Neal, who was playing for one of the farm teams of the Brooklyn Dodgers. They had several farm teams throughout eastern Canada, Nova Scotia, or eastern United States, including Nova Scotia, and baseball was a big fad, fad during this period. It rivaled hockey during mm-hmm. the post-war period in Nova Scotia, and we speculate that she never mentioned it to me, but I speculate that she probably met him at one of the games. That was love at first sight for her, and she was, you know, infatuated, and a young girl that was taken off her feet, and that led her in a different direction. She fell in love, and the parents were not so much willing or excited by the relationship. They saw that he was a flawed individual, but Wanda was very strong-willed, and she said, "No, I want this. I want to get married. I want to be with him." And they reluctantly agreed, and she got married and moved off to Massachusetts, near a little town near Boston, and Winthrop, Massachusetts. And he never really did anything. The Bomber Neal was tried a few places to find his niche in the professional, baseball circuit, but never really was successful. And he didn't make any money, and it left the Wanda really on her own. He was gone for weeks on end, and Wanda was left with virtually no money, and she had to start working. She worked in several jobs, part-time jobs and full-time jobs where she could get them, and tried to support her family. Now, by now, she had two kids, a third one on the way, and that, of course, made it very difficult for her to work outside the family. So she struggled. She really struggled. And she was really part of that whole era in the United States. The whole black family experience was under crisis during the 1940s and 50s, and she experienced the worst side of this, you know, terrible unemployment and poverty and dislocation. Eventually, she had good advice and found a lawyer through a local agency that offered support for people that needed it, and it was called the Red Feather Association, part of the United Way, I think it is now. It sort of morphed into the United Way. At any rate, she got a lawyer, and he said, "You better get out of this relationship." And she took the advice and decided to go back to Nova Scotia. And fortunately, she came back, and she was lucky enough to. She thought, well, I'll apply to the fisheries department. Maybe there's an opening. And she looked out because somebody that was working there decided to leave, who was just starting, and there was an opening. So she went back to the fisheries, and she worked there for, 23 years all told, which was quite a career in the fisheries department. So that's another major chapter of her life. So we have her childhood, her odyssey in the United States, in Boston, Chapter Two. We may have, you know, her return to Nova Scotia and raising her children and trying to make ends meet as a single parent. And there was ups and downs over that period as well. She finally, in the early 60s, met 66, I think it was. She met Joe, who was working at the fisheries just part time. He was a university student doing engineering at Dow, and trying to make ends meet himself. And so he was working at the fisheries for the summer. And they met and became friends. And then, of course, the rest of that is the story of a very successful 50-year-plus marriage, and two more children that she had under that marriage. And eventually, Joe got a job in teaching in North Sydney, and that brought them to Cape Breton.
That's terrific. Okay, Graham, I just want to thank you on behalf of myself and for all our Coast listeners to fill us in on this great story, The Life of Wanda Robson, by Breton Books, soon to be available everywhere. So once again, Graham, thanks very much.
Yeah, my pleasure. My pleasure.
That's all for Dialogue this week. If you have an idea for an interview on the program, send us an email to news@coastalradio.ca. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.